Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the December 14th Tuesday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Four killed, penalty handed out to trucker. Judge sentences Aguilera Menderos to 110 years in prison for deadly I-70 crash by Shelley Bradbury. Tornadoes in Midwest, thousands without heat or water by Bruce Schreiner and Claire Gallifaro. USA Gymnastics, $380 million settlement reached with more than 500 victims by Will Graves. Ban on flavored smoking products. Council fails to override veto by Mayor Hancock by Joe Rubino. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Four killed. Penalty handed out to trucker. Judge sentences Aguilera Medeiros to 110 years in prison for deadly I-70 crash by Shelley Bradbury, The Denver Post. The truck driver who killed four people when he drove his out-of-control semi-trailer into stopped traffic on Interstate 70 in Lakewood nearly 3 years ago was sentenced Monday to 110 years in prison. District Court Judge Bruce Jones imposed the sentence after finding it was the mandatory minimum sentence set forth under state law and that he had no discretion to impose a shorter prison term. I will state that if I had the discretion, it would not be my sentence, the judge said. Rogel Aguilera Medeiros, 26, lost his brakes in Colorado's high country and failed to take a runaway truck ramp before he rammed his speeding semi into stop traffic under an overpass in Lakewood on April 25, 2019, causing a fiery 28-car pileup that killed four people and wounded six others. Those killed were Miguel Angel Lamas Arellano, 24, William Bailey, 67, Doyle Harrison, 61, and Stanley Politano, 69. Sometimes it feels like being half a person when you lose your spouse, said Kathleen Harrison, who was married to Doyle Harrison. We were a team. A jury in October found Aguilera Medeiros guilty of four counts of vehicular homicide, six counts of first-degree assault, 10 counts of attempted first-degree assault, 4 counts of careless driving causing death, 2 counts of vehicular assault, and 1 count of reckless driving. Jones said he may revise the sentence in the future if Aguilera Medeiros seeks a review, and that he had no desire to see Aguilera Medeiros in prison for the rest of his life. I would say that perhaps the legislature, in imposing a requirement of consecutive sentences, had in mind that there might be cases where a judge should give it further consideration after hearing from the Department of Corrections. And this may very well be one of those cases, Jones said. Aguilera faces a mandatory minimum of 110 years in prison, though Aguilera Medeiros' attorney, James Colgan, argued Monday that case law allowed Jones to find a mandatory minimum sentence of 20 years. Colgan said the lighter sentence was more appropriate. There are no winners here, Judge, Colgan said. No one wins, no matter what. We have a courtroom full of broken lives. It's just tragic. There's no other way to put it. Aguilera Medeiros wept as he spoke during the sentencing. He apologized and asked the families of the victims for forgiveness and said he never intended to hurt or kill anyone. "I am not a criminal," he said. "I am not a murderer. I am not a killer. When I look at my charges, we are talking about a murderer, which is not me. I have never thought about hurting anybody in my entire life." He went on to say that his life since the crash has been difficult, depressing, terrible, and bad, and said he struggles to sleep and thinks constantly about the people who died. "I lost my brakes," he said, weeping. "The truck drivers, they know it's a hard moment. You can't do anything. You can't do anything." But prosecutors with the First Judicial District Attorney's Office said Aguilera Medeiros had several chances to stop the tragedy from happening and that his bad decisions directly led to the crash. "The crash was a crime, not an accident," said Duane Bailey, the brother of victim William Bailey. He asked Jones to sentence Aguilera Medeiros to at least 20 years in prison, though he said he did not personally seek a life sentence for Aguilera Medeiros. He made a deliberate and intentional decision that his life was more important than everyone else on the road that day, Bailey said. Most of the family members of the people who died in the crash asked that Aguilera Medeiros face prison time. They spoke of forgiveness coupled with accountability. "My dad was taken away from me," Megan Harrison said. "A huge person in my life, just never came home." Tornadoes in Midwest. Thousands without heat and water, by Bruce Schreiner and Claire Galliferro. The Associated Press, byline, Mayfield, Kentucky. Residents of Kentucky counties where tornadoes killed dozens of people could be without heat, water, or electricity in frigid temperatures for weeks or longer, state officials warned Monday, as the toll of damage and deaths came into clearer focus in five states slammed by a swarm of twisters. Kentucky authorities said the sheer level of destruction was hindering their ability to tally the damage from Friday night storms. At least 88 people, including 74 in Kentucky, were killed by the tornado outbreak that also destroyed a nursing home in Arkansas, heavily damaged an Amazon distribution center in Illinois, and spread its deadly effects into Tennessee and Missouri. In Kentucky, as searches continued for those still missing, efforts also turned to repairing the power grid, sheltering those whose homes were destroyed, and delivering drinking water and other supplies. "We're not going to let any of our families go homeless," Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear said in announcing that lodges and state parks were being used to provide shelter. In Mayfield, one of the hardest hit towns, those who survived faced a high in the 50s and a low below freezing Monday without any utilities. "Our infrastructure is so damaged. We have no running water. Our water tower was lost. Our wastewater management was lost, and there's no natural gas to the city. So we have nothing to rely on there," Mayfield Mayor Kathy Stewart Onan said on CBS Mornings. "So that is purely survival at this point for so many of our people." Across the state, about 26,000 homes and businesses were without electricity, according to poweroutage.us. including nearly all of those in Mayfield. More than 10,000 homes and businesses have no water, and another 17,000 are under boil water advisories, Kentucky Emergency Management Director Michael Dossett told reporters. Kentucky was the worst hit by far in the cluster of twisters across several states. Remarkable because they came at a time of year when cold weather normally limits tornadoes. At least 74 people died in the state, Beshear said Monday, offering the first specific count of the dead. In Bowling Green, Kentucky, 11 people died on the same street, including two infants found among the bodies of five relatives near a residence, Warren County Coroner Kevin Kirby said. Beshear warned that it could take days to pin down the full death toll. "With this amount of damage and rubble, it may be a week or even more before we have a final count on the number of lost lives," the governor said. Initially, as many as 70 people were feared dead in the Mayfield Consumer Products candle factory. But the company said Sunday that 8 deaths were confirmed and 8 people remained missing. On Monday evening, Louisville Emergency Management Director E.J. Myman said at a news conference that the company indicated everyone in the building during the storm had been accounted for. In addition to the deaths in Kentucky, the tornadoes also killed at least 6 people in Illinois, where the Amazon Distribution Center in Edwardsville was hit, 4 in Tennessee, 2 in Arkansas, where the nursing home was destroyed, and the governor said workers shielded residents with their own bodies, and 2 in Missouri. The Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration announced Monday that it has opened an investigation into the collapse of the Amazon warehouse in Illinois. Amazon's Kelly Nantel said the Illinois warehouse was constructed consistent with code. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker said there would be an investigation into updating code given serious change in climate that we are seeing across the country that appears to factor into stronger tornadoes. Not far from Mayfield, 67 people spent Sunday night at a church serving as a shelter in Wingo, and 40 more were expected to arrive Monday. Organizers were working to find a mobile outdoor shower facility and a laundry truck, expecting many of the displaced to need a long-term place to stay. Lifelong Mayfield resident Cynthia Gargas, 51, is staying with her daughter after the storm tore off the front of her apartment and sucked out almost everything inside. "I don't know. I don't see how we'll ever get over this," she said. "It won't ever be the same." USA Gymnastics, $380 million settlement reached with more than 500 victims, by Will Graves, the Associated Press. The legal wrangling between USA Gymnastics and the hundreds of victims of sexual abuse by former national team doctor Larry Nassar, among others, is over after a $380 million settlement was reached. The fight for substantive change within the sport's national governing body is just beginning. A federal bankruptcy court in Indianapolis on Monday approved the agreement between USA Gymnastics and the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee and the more than 500 victims, ending one aspect of the fallout of the largest sexual abuse scandal in the history of the U.S. Olympic movement. More than 90% of the victims voted in favor of the tentative settlement reached in September. That agreement called for $425 million in damages, but a modified settlement of $380 million was conditionally approved by the court. More than 300 victims were abused by Nassar, with the remaining victims abused by individuals affiliated with USA Gymnastics in some capacity. The financial reckoning is just one part of the equation. A series of non-monetary provisions will make the victims stakeholders at USA Gymnastics going forward. The provisions include a dedicated seat on the organization's Safe Sport Committee, Athlete Health and Wellness Council, and Board of Directors, as well as a thorough look at the culture and practices within USA Gymnastics that allowed abusers like Nassar to run unchecked for years. Individually and collectively, survivors have stepped forward with bravery to advocate for enduring change in the sport, USA Gymnastics President Lili Leung said in a statement after the settlement was approved. "We are committed to working with them and with the entire gymnastics community to ensure that we continue to prioritize the safety, health, and wellness of our athletes and community above all else." Hundreds of girls and women have said Nassar sexually abused them under the guise of medical treatment when he worked for Michigan State University, USA Gymnastics, which trains Olympians, and a Michigan gym that's a USA Gymnastics member. He pleaded guilty in federal court to child pornography crimes before pleading guilty in state court to sexually assaulting female gymnasts. He was sentenced in 2018 to 40 to 175 years in prison. Rachel Den Hollander, who in the fall of 2016 was the first woman to come forward to detail sexual abuse at the hands of Nassar, said the provisions were a pivotal part of the mediation process. "It's not about money, it's about change," Den Hollander told the Associated Press in a phone interview. "It's about an accurate assessment of what went wrong so that it is safer for the next generation." Den Hollander has been one of the most outspoken Nassar victims from the outset of the scandal. She said it was important to move past the legal proceedings so women can move forward with their lives and get the help they need. "The frank reality is, the longer this goes on, the more difficult it is for survivors," she said. "So many of these women, they can't access medical care without a settlement. We had to balance that reality with the length of time it was taking. We felt it was in the best interest of everyone to accept the settlement so that survivors could receive some semblance of justice." Den Hollander pointed out that some of the medical care required is not covered by certain types of insurance. "The settlement will ease part of the financial burden." The settlement comes nearly 4 years after an emotional sentencing hearing in Michigan in which hundreds of women detailed their experiences with Nassar and the toll it took on their lives. USOPC CEO Sarah Hirschland said the organization, which is paying $34 million of its own money and $73 million more from insurers toward the settlement, recognizes its role in failing to protect these athletes, and we are sorry for the profound hurt they have endured. Den Hollander described the 5+ years from when she first approached reporters at the Indianapolis Star to Monday as hellish. "It's been hellish for all of us," she said. "To have to push for so long for the right things to take place, to have to push for so long to have justice happen. It should have never taken 5 years." USA Gymnastics filed for bankruptcy in December 2018 in an effort to consolidate the various lawsuits filed against it. The move also forced the USOPC to halt the decertification process it began against USA Gymnastics. The organization has undergone a massive leadership overhaul in the interim and revamped its health and safety policies. The settlement will allow it to continue as the sport's national governing body, though Den Hollander stressed that USA Gymnastics has not gone far enough, which is why the involvement of the victims going forward is so significant. "We need to see for ourselves what reform is taking place," she said. "The ability to do that provides a level of accountability that hasn't been in place up until now." Ban on flavored smoking products. Council fails to override veto by Mayor Hancock, by Joe Rubino, the Denver Post. 8 Denver City Council members voted to overturn Mayor Michael Hancock's veto of a ban on flowered tobacco and smoking products, an ordinance that the same council approved just last week. But it wasn't enough. The threshold to overturn a mayoral veto is 9 votes. Council members Kendra Black, Chris Herndon, Kevin Flynn, and Jolan Clark voted in support of the veto on Monday night, snuffing out the ban well before its July 2023 effective date. City Council President Stacey Gilmore, who voted against the ban last week, was absent. Nearly outlawed products, including menthol cigarettes, mint chewing tobacco, and bubble gum flavored vape juice will remain on store shelves in Denver under the same laws governing the sale of a pack of regular cigarettes, available to anyone 21 and up with valid ID. Clark, who voted for the ban on December 6, switched his position Monday. He and other council members favor focusing on stepping up enforcement efforts to crack down on retailers supplying nicotine products to kids, rather than enacting a far-reaching ban on flavored products that would impact even stores complying with laws. We have found a way for 21 plus stores to work for marijuana, and I really believe that if we can get the enforcement and the fines and the taking away of licenses there, we can make it work for tobacco stores, Clark said. I think we can attack this issue with the scalpel it deserves. The ban has been in the works for more than a year. Councilwoman Amanda Sawyer started pursuing it after her teenage daughter was involved in a text chain with classmates trying to buy flavored vaping products online. Sawyer on Monday said she and her co-sponsor, Councilwoman Debbie Ortega, were involved in more than 100 meetings while trying to craft a narrowly tailored ordinance that would still accomplish the mission of keeping addictive products out of the hands of kids. Ortega on Monday said she was disappointed stepped-up enforcement efforts became a topic of conversation only when the bill was nearing a council vote and not months before when the ordinance was being written. Hancock and council members who opposed the ban argued that Denver acting unilaterally was meaningless because the city is surrounded by municipalities that allow the sale of flavored products. Of the six Colorado communities with similar legislation, only Edgewater shares a border with Denver. I didn't see that this bill singling Denver out would do anything to keep nicotine and vaping products from our young people, Hancock told the Denver Post on Friday. He echoed the concerns of some council members that the ordinance would unfairly hurt small businesses in the city that rely on the sale of flavored vaping products. Councilman Paul Cashman also reversed his vote Monday night, going from opposing the ban to supporting overriding the veto. While he empathized with the struggles small business owners face when government regulations change, he said he is tired of waiting for tobacco companies to grow a conscience and stop targeting young people, and tired of waiting for the federal government to step in and ban flavored products. My faith is not high that a second effort will produce a bill with as strong a commitment to keeping tobacco out of the hands of children, he said. Hancock has contacted members of the legislature about crafting a statewide ban on flavored products, he said Friday. Sawyer, facing the defeat of her ordinance, said Monday she too is committed to working on a statewide measure. Federal Boulevard and West 84th Avenue. Proposal draws opposition. Plan calls for 2,350 new homes on 233 acres in Westminster, by John Aguilar, the Denver Post. A proposal to build hundreds of homes and thousands of square feet of commercial space on century-old farmland with prize views to the mountains took center stage Monday night, with a newly seated Westminster City Council ready to decide the fate of a project that has spawned vigorous opposition and spurred organized protests from neighbors for years. The hearing on the Uplands project, with up to 2,350 homes slated for 233 acres around the intersection of West 84th Avenue and Federal Boulevard, drew more than 200 residents, both to council chambers and online. The meeting was expected to go late into the night, and Mayor Nancy McNally said the hearing would likely continue on Wednesday. Around 20 protesters showed up before Monday's meeting to denounce the project. The Uplands project has been pilloried by opponents as an overly dense development that doesn't match the surrounding neighborhood and is stingy with the amount of open space it is willing to dedicate to Westminster for parks and green space. The developer is coming in and wants to do less than the minimum public land dedication, said Karen Ray, a leader of the Save the Farm community group. People want open space, and open space doesn't mean five-story apartment buildings. It means views and wildlife that is allowed to be wild. To which, she says, of three tax measures that voters in Westminster considered during last month's election, only the one to fund open space purchases passed. A Change.org petition opposing the Uplands development has garnered more than 10,200 signatures. Proof that people don't want to see a farm dating back more than 100 years ago go away in a metro area that has seen relentless growth in the last decade, Ray said. Opponents also wonder how wise it is to bring online tens of thousands of square feet of additional retail space in a part of Westminster that has struggled to keep existing commercial space filled. Wouldn't it be better to revitalize existing space in the city rather than taking pristine farmland to put in commercial space we can't fill now? Ray said, "It's a treasure to have a working farm in an urban area. If they allow this to happen, this will be another faceless suburb with a view of nothing." Much of the focus on the Uplands project, which would be spread over five parcels of varying sizes, is directed at a 150-acre centerpiece plot bounded by Federal and Lowell Boulevards and West 84th and 88th Avenues. The property, once owned by the Pillar of Fire Church, is most recognizable by the 1890s-era Westminster Castle building that sits at its southwest corner. The church has allowed the land to be farmed for decades, but decided a few years ago to sell the property. Jeff Handlin, president of O'Reed Capital and Development and a principal in the Uplands project, said the company's blueprint dedicates 47 acres to parks and open space, land that neighbors will actually be able to touch and feel rather than just look at from afar. In the central parcel, that will amount to two 10-acre parks that will be open to the public. And design plans, Handlin said, call for building heights to decrease the farther west they go, from five stories to two stories, allowing views of the mountains from the parks to remain intact. While Westminster's planning rules require 12 acres of public land dedication per 1,000 people, equating to around 65 acres in the case of Uplands, Handlin said the city permits some cash in lieu of land dedication. Uplands is proposing to reduce its open space dedication at a cost of $5 million to $8 million. Handlin said public parks are scarce in the area, and Uplands plans, as currently envisioned, would provide for residents several parks that don't exist now. If this community is not approved, none of these parks become available to the public, Handlin said. The land will continue to be private, fenced and off-limits. Uplands responds to housing needs Westminster has recently identified, Handlin said, providing the missing middle in residential options. That means not just more single-family homes with spacious yards, but an array of more compact housing, duplexes, fourplexes, townhomes, and cottage homes, among others, that both retirees and young families can afford. It specifically calls for more diverse housing types, Handlin said, of the city's 2017 Housing Needs Assessment Report. He also said the Uplands proposal would bring in 3,400 fewer residents than what the city's comprehensive plan allows for the property, and approximately 300 of the residential units will be affordable. The Westminster Planning Commission last month unanimously recommended that the project be approved by the City Council. Despite that vote, Ray said she could see the city's newly elected officials going in a different direction this week. "This is the first test of this new city council," she said. "I'm hopeful. I think we have a chance." 2015 Gold King Mine Blowout, Colorado to collect $1.6 million. By Conrad Swanson, The Denver Post. The Sunnyside Gold Corporation will pay $1.6 million to settle environmental damage claims connected to the 2015 Gold King Mine spill that released a yellow plume of heavy metals into the Animas River, the Colorado Attorney General's office announced Monday. The agreement, which isn't yet finalized, stipulates that the money must go toward restoration projects within the Bonita Peak Mining District Superfund site, Attorney General spokesman Lawrence Pacheco said in a news release. It would also release the corporation from additional liability with the state moving forward. The $1.6 million settlement marks the latest in a series of such agreements, stemming from the Gold King mine spill. Sunnyside agreed earlier this year to pay $10 million to the Navajo Nation and $11 million to New Mexico. The newly announced settlement doesn't amount to much money when compared to the millions that already have been spent in the area, said Peter Butler, chair of the Bonita Peak Mining District Community Advisory Group. Most of that money went toward attorneys and consultants trying to determine liability rather than actual cleanup efforts, he said. I think all the different parties spent close to $70 million in the last 5 years, said Butler, a Durango resident. Not much cleanup effort, though, mostly all study, and there's been almost no improvement in water quality. Butler added that he's not surprised the settlement is so small. Part of that could be, he said, because Sunnyside has cooperated well with cleanup efforts. Another part of that could be because of the complicated liability issues surrounding the Gold King mine spill. A cleanup crew led by the Environmental Protection Agency inadvertently triggered the 3 million gallon spill, and the Denver Post reported in 2016 that the agency official overseeing the work knew of the blowout danger well beforehand. The spill sent at least 880,000 pounds of metals into the Animas River, through three states and across the land of two Native American tribes. It's an interesting tangled web of liability up there, said Marcel Gastabidi, who also sits on the advisory group with Butler. The Sunnyside Gold Corporation did not own the Gold King mine, nor was the corporation responsible for the 2015 spill. Gina Myers, director of the company's reclaiming operations, said in an email. Rather, Butler said, Sunnyside installed concrete bulkheads downstream from the mine, which raised water levels in the area, making the spill worse. For those in the area in August 2015, the spill was horrifying, Gastabidi said. The entire river turned bright orange, says Gastabidi, who was not in town at the time. There was a lot of concern for the fish in the river system. And there was more concern still for the farmers downstream, whose crops rely on that water, Gastabidi said. But for the folks that knew the most about the Animas River, it wasn't a big surprise, Gastambidi said. We've known about the problem of acid mine drainage for a long time. He called the 2015 blowout a symptom of a much larger problem of abandoned mines in the area. Research into the environmental damage caused by the spill and the other mines continues, Gastambidi added. So it's difficult to say whether $1.6 million is enough. For context, Butler said the EPA is currently cleaning drainage coming out of the mine, and operating that treatment plant costs about $2.5 million a year. So $1.6 million wouldn't even run that for a year, he said. Still, Gastambidi said the money can be put to good use in what amounts to a massive cleanup project within which much work remains. In a statement, Attorney General Phil Weiser called the settlement a step in the right direction to address the damage suffered in southwest Colorado and the Four Corners region. If the settlement is finalized, Colorado Natural Resources trustees will use the money for projects meant to restore damage from the 2015 spill and other hazardous releases in the area, Pacheco said. The agreement itself will be filed Monday in U.S. District Court in Denver, starting a 30-day public comment process. The judge overseeing the case will then consider the agreements and comments submitted before deciding whether to accept the settlement. Denver, Robinson, city's top public safety official, to leave post. By Sam Tabachnik, Elise Schmelzer, and Joe Rubino. The Denver Post. Denver's top public safety official, Murphy Robinson, on Monday announced he will be leaving his position next month. I have not approached this decision lightly, Robinson said in a news release. Serving as a director of public safety has been one of the greatest honors of my life. Robinson, who's been executive director of the Denver Department of Public Safety since January 2020, said he's been planning to leave for some time. As director of the department, he oversaw the city's police, fire, and sheriff's departments. A nominee to replace him will be announced in the coming days, city officials said in the news release. Robinson previously worked as executive director of the Department of General Services and chief operating officer for the mayor's office. He succeeded Troy Riggs as head of public safety after Riggs left less than 2 years after taking the position. Anderson led the safety department through the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as massive protests of police brutality that overtook the city for multiple days in 2020. His resignation comes as Denver's public safety agencies deal with a record-breaking spike in homicides and increases in other crimes, including car thefts. The Department of Public Safety lauded Robinson for helping implement the Pepsi Center COVID-19 Testing Center, hosting the MLB All-Star Game this summer, and launching an inmate voting program in Denver's jail, among other accomplishments. In the 4 years since he first joined my administration, Murphy has proven to be not only an outstanding public servant, but also a true asset to our city and our residents, Mayor Michael Hancock said in a statement. He is a rising leader who never shied away from a challenge and approached problem solving with a true innovative and collaborative spirit. Hancock, in December 2020, also named Robinson the city's deputy mayor. Robinson has been criticized for how Denver police responded to the 2020 protests, during which peaceful protesters were hit with less lethal weapons like sponge rounds and pepper balls. An investigation by the city's law enforcement oversight agency found that the city's officers were ill-prepared to respond to the large-scale protests, used excessive force on protesters, and that the response was disorganized. He also raised hackles in January when he removed representatives from the Department of Public Safety from a large community-led task force working to reform public safety in Denver in the wake of the protests. Director Robinson was in way over his head in this role, and it showed in his unilateral and often reckless decision-making, City Councilwoman Candy Sidibaka said Monday. While his departure could potentially be a good sign under a responsive administration, we know better than to expect that from this lame duck mayor. Robinson also made waves in August when he alleged that Lisa Calderon, Sidibaka's former chief of staff, refused to meet with his new city council liaison because she's white. Calderon, in an op-ed piece for Westword, called the story patently false. In an interview Monday, Calderon called Robinson one of the least competent public safety directors I have worked with from a community standpoint and a professional standpoint. Robinson did not return a request for an interview Monday, and a spokeswoman for the public safety department said he was not available. The news release did not say what his next job will be. Robinson is one of several Hancock-appointed department heads that have departed the city in recent months. Hancock is term-limited and will not be eligible to run for re-election in 2022. COVID-19 in Colorado. Cases, hospitalizations keep falling, but danger to unvaccinated still high. Admissions to facilities at lowest level since November. By Meg Wingerter, The Denver Post. Colorado's COVID-19 hospitalizations are continuing to fall, but facilities are still strapped, and the virus remains a widespread danger for people who aren't vaccinated. Hospitalizations for confirmed COVID-19 across the state dropped to 1,294 on Monday, their lowest level since early November, but still slightly higher than in spring 2020. the percentage of tests coming back positive also continued to fall, and new cases reported to the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment dropped to 12,446 in the week ending Sunday, from 16,928 a week earlier. The number of cases probably will rise somewhat as delayed reports come in, though. The hospital workforce situation remained tight, however, with just more than half of facilities reporting they would be short on staff in the next week, and 36% saying they expected a shortage of beds in intensive care units. Meanwhile, statewide, 99 intensive care beds and 541 general beds were available. While COVID-19 isn't the primary reason for people to seek hospital care, it's another stressor at a time when there's little slack in the healthcare system. About 84% of those hospitalized for COVID-19 are unvaccinated. Hospitals are admitting about 130 people each day for COVID-19, which is still significantly higher than Colorado's low point in August 2020, when they reported about 15 daily admissions, said Beth Carlton, an associate professor of environmental and occupational health at the Colorado School of Public Health. "We have a long way to go in terms of reducing hospital demand," she said. "We continue to see infections tear through unvaccinated communities. Although it's too late to develop the highest level of immunity before Christmas, if you get your booster today, it's still worth getting whatever increased protection you can, particularly if you're planning to gather with relatives who are at a higher risk of severe disease if they catch the virus," Carlton said. "The thing I keep thinking about is boosters, boosters, boosters," she said. "Unvaccinated people who got their first shot would also develop some protection. But the state health department recommends that those who aren't 2 weeks out from their second Moderna or Pfizer shot or their first Johnson & Johnson shot avoid gathering with people who aren't in their household. The Delta variant is still dominant in Colorado, with only 2 cases of the new Omicron variant confirmed so far. While it's still uncertain if Omicron causes less severe symptoms than Delta, it's becoming increasingly clear that Omicron is at least as contagious as Delta and is more likely to reinfect people who've recovered from a previous variant. People who have had 3 shots seem to be better protected at this point, though. Omicron is starting to outcompete Delta in the United Kingdom, and while it's not guaranteed that the same thing will happen in the United States, American COVID-19 numbers usually follow the same trends as European ones. What's happened in the UK has happened here with uncanny levels of similarity," Carlton said. DIA offering vaccine booster clinic by Sam Tabachnik, The Denver Post. Employees and even passengers on their way out of town can now get their COVID-19 vaccine booster at Denver International Airport, airport officials announced in a news release. DIA officials are opening a booster clinic for several days this month. Wednesday, December 15th, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Sunday, December 19th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Tuesday, December 21st, 2 to 8 p.m. Monday, December 27th, 2 to 8 p.m. Wednesday, December 29th, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. The clinic is located on the fourth floor of the Hotel and Transit Center on the far northwest side of the airport plaza. Signs labeled Health Appointment will be visible on the plaza in front of Tom's Urban Restaurant. Then direct north toward the terminal to the entrance of the vaccination clinic, airport officials said in a news release. Safeway Albertsons will be administering the booster shots. Both Pfizer and Moderna vaccines will be offered. You can register online at https://mhealth-check-in.com/for appointments. And walk-ins will not be accepted. airport officials asked for people to complete the Safeway Albertsons release form prior to their appointment. Individuals with insurance are asked to bring their medical and prescription insurance cards to the appointment, but even those without insurance can still receive the booster for free. Russia blocks UN move to treat climate as security threat. Russia on Monday blocked a United Nations Security Council draft resolution under negotiation for months that for the first time would have defined climate change as a threat to peace. The resolution, which enjoyed wide-ranging support, would have significantly expanded the criteria used by the most powerful UN agency to justify intervening in armed conflicts around the world. Russia's derailment of the measure underscored the challenges faced by the United Nations in uniting the global community to combat climate change, which Secretary General Antonio Guterres and others have called an existential threat. Despite progress made to counter greenhouse gas emissions with an agreement reached at the UN-sponsored climate summit in Glasgow, Scotland last month, that accord fell short of what many scientists say will be required to curb rising temperatures and disastrous changes in weather patterns from a warming planet. Among other weaknesses, the agreement left unclear how the most vulnerable nations will be able to afford the enormous investments needed to adapt. The possible role of climate change in armed conflicts has long been a subject of discussion at the United Nations and elsewhere. Droughts and desertification aggravated by climate change in Mali, Niger, and other parts of Africa, for example, are thought to be integral to the competition for water, food, farmland, and pasture land that can lead to violence and instability. The Security Council draft resolution, co-sponsored by Ireland and Niger, the Council's current president, was a version of what was initially proposed in 2020 by Germany, but never put to a vote. The Ireland-Niger draft would have obliged the 15-member body to include climate change as a factor regarding any root causes of conflict or risk multipliers. It also would have asked the Secretary General to make regular reports on how to address the risks from climate change in preventing conflicts. The vote on the resolution in the 15-member council was 12 in favor, with Russia and India opposed and China abstaining. Because Russia is one of the council's five veto-wielding permanent members, its negative vote blocked passage. Vasily A. Nebenzia, Russia's UN ambassador, said it regarded the resolution as a pretext by wealthy Western powers to justify meddling in the internal affairs of other countries. This is from the New York Times Company. January 6th riot. Panel votes for contempt charges against Meadows by Mary Claire Jelonek and Farnoosh Amiri. The Associated Press. Byline, Washington. The House panel investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection voted Monday to recommend contempt charges against former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows as lawmakers demand his testimony about then-President Donald Trump's actions before and during the attack. Whatever legacy he thought he left in the House, this is his legacy now, Committee Chairman Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi, said of Meadows, a former Republican congressman from North Carolina, in his opening remarks. His former colleagues singling him out for criminal prosecution because he wouldn't answer questions about what he knows about a brutal attack on our democracy. That's his legacy. The committee voted 9-0 to move forward with criminal charges against Meadows, who declined to appear for a deposition last week. Lawmakers had planned to ask about Trump's efforts to overturn the election in the weeks before the insurrection, including Meadows' outreach to states and his communications with members of Congress. Trump's former top White House aide, is uniquely situated to provide key information, having straddled an official role in the White House and unofficial role related to Mr. Trump's reelection campaign, the panel said in a 51-page report released Sunday evening. The report detailed the questions lawmakers have about the thousands of emails and texts Meadows had provided to the committee before he ended his cooperation, including 6,600 pages of records taken from personal email accounts and about 2,000 text messages. The panel has not released all the documents, but the report says they include exchanges about Meadows' efforts to help Trump overturn his defeat in the presidential election, communications with members of Congress and organizers of a rally held the morning of the insurrection, and frantic messages among aides and others as the violent attack unfolded that day. Representative Liz Cheney, the committee's vice chair, detailed on Monday a series of text messages Meadows received on January 6th from a slew of people, including Fox News anchors and Donald Trump Jr. In the text, allies and those in Trump's inner circle attempted to reach Trump through his chief of staff, imploring him to take action against the violence that was taking place outside and inside the Capitol. "He's got to condemn this ASAP," Trump Jr. wrote. "The Capitol Police tweet is not enough." Meadows responded, saying, "I'm pushing it hard. I agree." "Hey, Mark, the president needs to tell people in the Capitol to go home. This is hurting all of us. He is destroying his legacy," Fox News host Laura Ingraham texted Meadows. As part of its list of questions for Meadows, the panel says it wants to know more about whether Trump was engaged in discussions regarding the response of the National Guard, which was delayed for hours as the violence escalated and the rioters beat police guarding the Capitol building. The documents provided by Meadows include an email he sent to an unidentified person saying that the Guard would be present to protect pro-Trump people, the panel said, and that more would be available on standby. The committee did not release any additional details about the email. The contempt vote is coming after more than 2 months of negotiations with Meadows and his lawyer, and as the panel has also struggled to obtain information from some of Trump's other top aides, such as his longtime ally Steve Bannon. The House voted to recommend charges against Bannon in October, and the Justice Department indicted him on 2 counts of contempt last month. In news briefs, California is reinstating mask mandate. California will once again require residents to wear masks in indoor public settings everywhere in the state as the Omicron variant rapidly spreads and the virus surges as the holidays approach. The indoor mask mandate will go into effect Wednesday and will remain until at least January 15th, state officials said Monday. The state will also require unvaccinated people attending so-called mega events to show proof of a negative coronavirus test result from within a day if it's an antigen test, and from within 2 days if it's a PCR test. Air Force discharges 27 for refusal to get vaccine. Byline, Washington. The Air Force has discharged 27 people for refusing to get the COVID-19 vaccine, making them what officials believe are the first service members to be removed for disobeying the mandate to get the shots. The Air Force gave its forces until November 2nd to get the vaccine, and thousands have either refused or sought an exemption. Air Force spokeswoman Ann Stefanik said Monday that these are the first airmen to be administratively discharged for reasons involving the vaccine. The Pentagon earlier this year required the vaccine for all members of the military, including active duty, National Guard, and the reserves. Each of the services set its own deadlines and procedures for the mandate, and the Air Force set the earliest deadline. Insurer agrees to $800 million settlement in Boy Scouts bankruptcy. Byline, Dover, Delaware. Attorneys in the Boy Scouts of America bankruptcy case have reached a tentative settlement under which one of the organization's largest insurers would contribute $800 million into a fund for victims of child sexual abuse. The agreement announced Monday calls for Century Indemnity Company and affiliated companies to contribute $800 million into the fund in return for being released from further liability for abuse claims. The payment would bring the amount of money in the proposed trust to more than $2.6 billion, which would be the largest sexual abuse settlement in U.S. history. The settlement comes as more than 82,000 sexual abuse claimants face a December 28th deadline to vote on a previously announced Boy Scouts reorganization plan. Chauvin expected to plead guilty in Floyd's civil rights case. Byline, Minneapolis. Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin appears to be on the verge of pleading guilty to violating George Floyd's civil rights, according to a notice sent out Monday by the court's electronic filing system. The federal docket entry shows a hearing has been scheduled for Wednesday for Chauvin to change his current not guilty plea in the case. Chauvin has already been convicted of state murder and manslaughter charges for pinning his knee against Floyd's neck as a black man said he couldn't breathe during a May 25th, 2020 arrest. He was sentenced to 22 years in that case. This is from Denver Post Wire Services. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.